Our last speaker for the panel will be Dr. Ehlers. Dr. Ehlers is a senior fellow at the Department of General Surgery at the University of Washington and the winner of the ACSPA Surgeons PAC Rising Star Award in 2017. Dr. Ehlers will be talking to us today about management of non-elective surgeries, and as a trauma surgeon, I will be paying close attention here.
Thank you so much. All right, so as mentioned, I'm going to be discussing management of antithrombotic therapy in the non-elective setting. Much of this may feel like review from some of the previous topics, but we're really going to be looking at it with the angle of in the acute situation where you need to bring the patient to the operating room within several hours, if not 5 minutes ago, what you should be thinking about in terms of reversal strategies for your high-risk patient. I have no disclosures. So similarly to the elective setting, one of the biggest considerations in the emergent or non-elective setting is balancing the risk of continued bleeding versus risk of clotting. And so thinking about the procedure that you're planning on doing, whether the patient's already bleeding, and taking into account what you know, if anything, about their past medical history can help be a useful guide to you when you're thinking about this. Unlike the previous talks where we saw there's a lot of high-level evidence, some of it based on randomized controlled trials, in the elective setting, a lot of this is based on expert consensus and case series. And so take everything with a grain of salt and think about it in that context. But the goal here really is to discuss strategy for management of antithrombotics and really to give you some things to take home so that you can say, oh, I remember there might be a reversal agent for this, or give you some resources to think about in when you have those more emergent patients. Starting with non-oral anticoagulants, so the heparins, unfractionated heparin, so this might be a patient that had surgery a couple days ago, is being bridged back to Coumadin, and suddenly develops bleeding that you realize you have to take them back to the operating room. As mentioned previously, the half-life is pretty short, so 60 to 90 minutes. So generally, once you make the decision to take the patient back to the operating room, you can just turn the heparin drip off, and it should be fine by the time you make it down there. However, if you are knowing that you're going to be making an incision within 30 to 60 minutes and it's a particularly high-risk operation, you can consider giving protamine, which is a pretty well-known reversal agent for heparin. The dosing is usually 1 milligram of protamine for every 80 to 120 units of unfractionated heparin. So you can kind of dose out how much they may have gotten in the previous hours prior to going to surgery to decide how much protamine to give. For the low molecular weight heparin, as mentioned previously, the half-life does vary depending on the drug, but for example, for enoxaparin, it's 4.5 to 7 hours. And as we discussed previously, for elective surgery, we usually stop this 24 hours. So unless the patient has really just gotten their dose 1 to 2 hours prior to the making the decision that you need to go back to the operating room or have an intervention, again, you can probably just go forward and operate. However, like the unfractionated heparin, if you know that this is a particularly high-risk operation or you're very worried because let's say the patient just got their full dose 1 hour ago, protamine is partially effective. So it's not going to reverse it as much as for the unfractionated heparin, but it can do some of the work. Dosing's a little bit different. It's 1 milligram of protamine per 1 milligram of enoxaparin. And again, if you're using a different low molecular weight heparin, the dosing may vary a little bit, so you'll have to review that. Going on to the vitamin K antagonists, we've talked a lot about this today. So these are our warfarin-type drugs. Vitamin K can be an effective antidote. The dose is usually 1 to 2 milligrams. So previously we talked about if your patient's coming for their elective operation, you realize their INR is too high, you can give 1.5 milligrams. If you have a couple hours to wait and the patient's INR might be kind of borderline, this could be a consideration. Keep in mind that the IV dose has a more rapid effect than PO. So if you really need to reverse them quickly, PO is probably not the best strategy because it can take 1 to 2 days to actually be effective. The other important consideration in this case is that sometimes giving vitamin K perioperatively can make it very difficult to achieve a therapeutic INR after the operation. So if you think that this is someone who maybe it's going to be a relatively quick operation, you know exactly what the problem is, and you're going to be quickly bridging them back onto their Coumadin postoperatively and really want to get them therapeutic, this may not be the best strategy for your armamentarium. Next is fresh frozen plasma, or FFP, something that I think most of us are familiar with. This includes all of the coagulation factors except for platelets, and as well as fibrinogen. The dose is actually quite high, so I think normally when I was in training, we thought, oh, their INR is high, let's give them a dose of FFP and see how that changes. But there is actually dosing guidelines. It's 15 to 30 milligrams per kilogram, and so for a 70 kilogram person, a full dose could be 1 to 2 liters based on the amount of product that's usually in a typical bag of FFP. There are available some kind of challenging equations where you can really plug in the patient's weight, patient's INR, and it can give you a specific dose of FFP and how much you can expect their INR to change. But from what we could gather, these haven't been very well validated and they're pretty clunky and difficult to use. So generally, kind of use your best estimate based on how high their INR is, again, how risky the bleeding is for that operation, and then keep in mind this dose of 15 to 30 milligrams per kilogram. And then something that's certainly been around for a while, but I think a lot of us are less familiar with than fresh frozen plasma, is the prothrombin complex concentrates. And these are really concentrated versions of factors. They come in a couple different forms. You can see there's 3-factor, that includes 2, 9, and 10, and then 4-factor, often marketed as Kcentra, and that includes everything that's in 3-factor as well as 7. And this is something that is likely carried at your hospital, but you need to be familiar with what version you have, because in particular, if a patient has a specific factor deficiency, probably less likely, but good to keep in mind in these cases. Compared to FFP, it's really nice because there is more predictable dosing based on weight and INR. So this is an example of one of those dosing calculators. This is very easy to find. This is for the specific drug Kcentra, which, as I mentioned, is one of the more commonly available forms of PCC. This was pulled up off of a desktop computer, could be easily accessed on your smartphone. And essentially, you can enter the patient's body weight, what range their INR is, and then it's going to give you a very precise estimate of how much of the drug you should give them to achieve reversal of their INR. So this can be a really good resource if you're thinking, I really need to reverse my patient in the next 1 to 2 hours. I've never given this drug. I don't know how much to give. So keep this resource in mind next time you're faced with that. So one thing that I always wondered was, looking at FFP versus PCC, when should you give one versus the other? What are the differences? Looking first at FFP, we all know that it's widely available. Most blood banks carry it as part of their standard inventory. One of the downsides is that it does require thawing, so it's frozen. And so you'll have to find out from your institutional blood bank, if you need FFP urgently, how long will it take for that to be available and how long will it take to thaw? Because sometimes that may be 30 minutes, an hour, or longer, depending on the resources at your institution. And then another consideration, as I mentioned previously, is that often a large volume of this medication or this product is needed to adequately reverse the INR. And so for a 70 kilogram person, and we all know that many of our patients are a lot larger than 70 kilograms, 1 to 2 liters of product may be necessary. And so especially in a patient that may be getting fluid resuscitated for other reasons, such as needing blood products or crystalloid if they're septic. This could really lead to a problem of fluid overload. The advantage is that it's relatively affordable. As always, it's difficult to find precise estimates, but one estimate that I found said that usually one bag of FFP is about $75 versus closer to $5,000 for a full dose of PCC, as we'll see. So looking then at PCC comparatively, as previously mentioned, the formulation does vary by hospital. So you'll have to make sure, number one, that you have it at your hospital, which like you do, but understanding which version you have. It requires reconstitution, so just as you have to plan a little bit ahead for the FFP to thaw it, this comes usually in a powdered form, so you have to know how long does it take to get that, how long does it take to reconstitute, so what's going to be the time interval between ordering it and having it available at the bedside for your patient. One good advantage compared to FFP is there's a lot less volume, so 100 cc's of Kcentra is equal to about 2,500 cc's of FFP. This is data that's available on their website. So again, thinking about that patient where you're particularly concerned about fluid overload, this can be a great alternative. But the downside, as I mentioned, is that it's expensive, thousands of dollars versus maybe only a few hundred for FFP. Taking this all into consideration when we were working on our paper and really trying to figure out what recommendation we can give to our community for managing these patients, we concluded that for patients with an elevated INR secondary to warfarin who are actively bleeding and or require urgent surgery, administering vitamin K in addition to four-factor PCC is the most effective strategy. So now getting into the direct oral anticoagulants, as we've already discussed, lots of different names for this class of drugs, but the main idea is understanding that different mechanisms of action than what we've all been working with for many years. And so if you can kind of be familiar with, like we talked about before, when to hold them preoperatively in the elective setting, but this point is more to think about, okay, my patient's coming in, they took Pradaxa 12 hours ago, and now they are bleeding, how to manage that. So two classes, direct thrombin inhibitors and factor 10A inhibitors. General things to remember about them, that there's no monitoring parameters. So unlike warfarin where you can check an INR or heparin where you can check their PTT to get a good sense of how therapeutic it is, there's no test available to say, are they super therapeutic? And this again gets to the idea that there's very predictable pharmacology, and so we don't generally have to test how therapeutic they are. As mentioned previously, there's drug-specific half-life, so you'll have to be familiar, but generally patients hold them 1 to 2 days before elective surgery, and the half-life depends on their underlying renal function. But being familiar with that can be helpful. But the biggest thing that we'll go through is that unlike some of these other medications that we talked about, there are very few reversal agents, only one that's currently FDA approved that I'll describe. But these are the patients that you'll have to just be aware of that when you're taking them for an emergent surgery, there may be a higher risk of bleeding because there's not a lot we can do to reverse these. Looking first at direct thrombin inhibitors, the main drug available in the market is dabigatran, and this is the only direct oral anticoagulant that has approved known reversal strategies. So the first is that it can be removed by hemodialysis, although this is probably less helpful in the emergent setting unless your patient for some reason already has dialysis access. But there is a recently approved FDA-approved drug called idarucizumab, or Praxbind, and this is a monoclonal antibody specifically against dabigatran. And so if your patient, you know, had surgery 3 days ago, they just got started back on their dabigatran, and now they're bleeding, they took their dabigatran 12 hours ago, this may be a useful adjunct as you're deciding next steps, or if you decide you need to take them to the operating room. And the dosing is standard. It's 5 milligrams IV over 5 minutes. Next is the factor 10A inhibitors. There's three of these on the market right now: rivaroxaban or Xarelto, apixaban, which is Eliquis, and edoxaban or Cevesa. Right now, there are no antidotes available. I know one of the previous talks mentioned adnexet alpha. As far as I know, this has not yet been approved, and so it's not yet on the market. There's some evidence that if your patient happened to take this within the last 2 hours, you can use activated charcoal, although this is probably less helpful as your patient probably, if they took it 2 hours ago, probably took it yesterday and the day before. So some evidence that four-factor PCC can be used, and so if you're really in a pinch, patient is bleeding, have a high-risk operation, you can attempt giving them the four-factor PCC, and this may alleviate some of those issues. And then finally, looking at antiplatelet agents, aspirin, like we've discussed multiple times, likely a low bleeding risk. And so if you're not particularly concerned about bleeding, or you know this patient has had a recent MI or a recent some other issue that they need, then you can operate through this. However, in certain circumstances, you may consider giving platelets, and this doesn't necessarily reverse the aspirin, but just provides functional platelets. And similarly for the non-aspirin anticoagulants, so clopidogrel, prasugrel, ticlopidine, if necessary, you can operate through them, again, taking into consideration the patient's recent cardiac history, et cetera. But if you do need to, then you can give 10 milligrams per kilogram of pooled platelets. And this usually, for practical purposes, equates to, like at my institution, a six-pack of platelets or whatever the standard is that you would order from the blood bank. So, you know, I hope this has provided some general guidelines and thoughts of what to expect and what to think about when you're faced with a patient who needs to urgently go to the operating room and is anticoagulated. I think, obviously, it's probably impossible, unless you do this every day, to remember each of the specifics about every single drug, but if you can at least be familiar with some of the high-level guidelines, and you can say, oh, I think this might be one that I could use PCC for, or, and then you can have a starting point. Second, again, as I've mentioned multiple times, really being familiar with what your institution offers, how long it's going to take you to get certain things, what versions are available. And along the same note, utilizing your colleagues and resources. So you've heard us say multiple times today, always consult with the patient's cardiologist or whoever's prescribing their anticoagulants. But in this case, really becoming friends with your pharmacist or the cardiologist or vascular surgeons or whoever it is in your institution, so that if you really need to make sort of a decision within the next 30, 60 minutes, if not quicker, you know who to go to, you've talked with them before, and they can be a really good resource for you. Thank you.
I just, can we get the mics on the desk, please? And then are there maybe a mic for folks to ask questions? We wanted to make sure that there was a great deal of time left for questions because this is such an important topic. And I think they did an outstanding job of reiterating some of the key points so that they are take-home points. I will also emphasize the fact that the guideline comes out, I believe, in November in JAX, so please keep an eye out for that, because a lot of what we're discussing here today will give that information to you, and you can use that as a resource. While we're figuring out how the audience can possibly ask questions, I'll start. So Melissa, I'll start with you. When you were putting together this paper and considering how you're going to go out and practice, how would you recommend that we incorporate the CHADS-2 vascular risk modifying situation so that in a preoperative clinic? And is that something that you do at your institution at The Ohio State?
I
issues work. You working on the mics? Come on up.
So at The Ohio State University, I do believe we incorporate the CHA2DS2-VASc score on our patients that have atrial fibrillation that we're trying to guide their thromboembolic risk. So it's a fairly straightforward algorithm that, similar to what Annie was speaking to about figuring out your PCC dose, there are apps available where you can just kind of plug in, look at your patient and plug in all their risk factors, and it'll add it up for you. Even though it's only adds up to about 10 or 12, it will help you with the math. So yeah, it's a pretty easy thing to fit into your pre-op kind of system in your clinic.
I just want to add one. Maybe I'll get a little closer.
There we go. I'll be the first to admit that I don't remember the CHA2DS2-VASc score regularly. And I think that's true for a lot of people, so I'm just going to put that out there. I think one thing that we've done at our institution is that we have a preoperative anesthesia clinic now, and that's actually made a world of difference because it really helps, especially there's going to be more and more of these drugs coming on the market, and I think in reality it's hard to keep track of everything. So we've really tried to do that here with the talks, but also the manuscript. But I think those kind of things, using the resources that you have at your own institution to help you, I think is also important.
So Eric, along those lines, we in the Board of Governors meeting and some in my particular quality pillar lead meeting, we had a hefty conversation about the concept of a surgical home for our patients. How many people in the audience have a preoperative or a perioperative clinic that is run by surgeons or people who work for the surgeons? Very few. How many have it run by anesthesia? How many people have it run by internal medicine? Okay, so this is a topic that's going to be probably more at the forefront as things change, not only with reimbursements, but with quality metrics, some of which was alluded to, I think, you know, when Paul talked about making sure you dot your I's and cross your T's, is that how much does the surgeon really want to abdicate to the other specialists? And so along those lines, we have a perioperative clinic that we started that's run by advanced practice folks who work for us, and so it becomes a one-stop shop, and the idea is that not only patients get excellent care, but they also get things done much more efficiently and therefore much more cost-effectively. So do you see something like perioperative anticoagulation as something that should be part of the surgical home?
I do. Yeah, personally, I do for sure. I think it is a part of ours actually now, and I think it's critical because there's so many complications that happen after surgery related to bleeding or thromboembolism events that it's and many of them are preventable, frankly, if the medications are managed properly. So,
right. So, any? Yes, sir.
Not that I'm aware of, and like I said, a lot of this is sort of based on expert guidelines, but to my understanding, there's not a specific protocol described for that, but you could, it's a good question, because you can't use the INR, but I think that's a circumstance where discussing that in advance with your pharmacist or your other colleagues could be useful in case you face that scenario, but yeah, no specific dosing at this time.
Well, to that, and how many people are using TEG more routinely to determine if they're going to start giving other methods of reversals? Just one hand, more hands. And this is where I was seeing more in my institution. Leslie, do you want to comment of how you got, what you guys are doing in San Diego?
Yeah, sure. So with regard to the PCC, It varies from pharmacy to pharmacy. There are very specific guidelines for INR reversal in patients on warfarin that are somewhat translational to patients who have elevated INRs because of liver disease. In general, at our institution at UCSD, it breaks down to a high dose and a low dose PCC reversal. And for the patients who are on the oral anti-10A inhibitors, if we are using PCC to reverse, we will generally give a single dose of the low dose of the PCC, which is, relatively speaking, reasonable in terms of cost. It's difficult to say how to evaluate both the therapeutic effect of the anticoagulant in your patient, depending on when they took their meds, if they can even remember that, and then any impact of any attempts at reversal, since these drugs, they don't really have an impact on either traditional methods of coagulation like INR or PTT, nor do they really seem to have an effect on TEG values such as R-time or lysis. We did a large study including 16 trauma institutions, and looking at the patients on the DOACs and NOACs, there was absolutely no visible effect in terms of INR, PTT, TEG, R-time, anything from the measures of anticoagulation. All of their numbers were either strictly in the normal range to being hypercoagulable in the majority of patients. And it also didn't seem to display any sort of impact from the attempts at reversal, which occurred in about 18% of the patients.
Thank you. That was excellent. Paul, I have a quick question for you while other folks are thinking of questions. You know, you spoke about bridging, and particularly as it relates to the warfarin and in situations needing to start your low molecular weight heparin, ideally a day before. Do you have a process in place, or are you aware of processes in place that allow folks to do that? Because very few people are coming in the day before surgery for anything. I mean, back in the day, we used to bring them in for their bowel prep. We don't do that anymore. They're doing things at home. So is there a mechanism, or is that something that we need to be looking at as a house of surgery to help put out standards to, again, incorporate the surgical home for our patients so that we're not relegating things to our medical colleagues when we want better control over it?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. At our institution, I implement that in the office with my nurse. And so I might see them prior to having their heart surgery, you know, 3 weeks before we do it. But we lay it all out. We write it out when they're supposed to stop it and when they're supposed to stop Lovenox. The problem is often they're going in for their pre-op testing the day prior to surgery or 2 days prior to surgery, and there's not time to do any of that. I think in the general surgery patients and cardiac and vascular, we're more in tune to that, but often we'll see ortho patients showing up the day prior for their pre-op testing and they're still anticoagulated and the surgery has to get, you know, canceled. So I think each individual surgeon needs to be thinking about that. If they're going to totally defer it to somebody else, to a preoperative home run by whoever, they need to make sure there's enough time before the patient gets there. It is becoming more and more common that patients are managing their own Coumadin, checking their INR at home if they have the mental wherewithal to do that. And so if I have a patient that does that, I will talk to them about that and say, you know, check your INR every day at home, and when it gets less than 2.5, then start the Lovenox shots and we give them, you know, a week's worth or whatever. But honestly, the patients that aren't checking it at home and they're just sort of the routine kind of patient, usually I start the Lovenox on, you know, that after they've stopped it for 2 days and go forward. But one comment I will make, it does behoove you to know where you're starting. And I've had patients who I'm seeing in the office and they need upcoming heart surgery, and I check their INR and it's 6. And they're just not being followed appropriately or very loosely. And that person may take a lot longer to come down. And other people, I'll check it and it's, 1.8, and they already need to be on something. So from my standpoint, when I have the patient on warfarin in the office, I will usually do an INR right then in the office or send them for it that day, unless I have evidence in the EMR that, you know, they're getting it checked regularly and every 2 weeks it's been something. But I think it behooves you to have some clue where you're starting. And more often than not, the patient's not in the therapeutic range. They're above and below it. when they're seeing you in the office for their pre-op testing.
I think that's an outstanding point about knowing where you're starting from. Any other questions from the audience? Yes, sir, back there. Yep. Did you guys hear that question? The question was related to thrombophilia.
I think that's a really good question, but that would be a situation that I would get the hematologist involved. I'm not exactly sure whether that it would have an effect on those patients.
And I think that brings up a good point. Again, going back to the surgical home, when we're more in control over how we're perioperatively managing the medical issues of these patients, we also know who's going to see the cardiologist for those select situations where they need it, or the ones who need to go see a hematologist, oncologist. I just want to give a shout out to the Dr. Lucas and Ledgerwood, who are icons in acute care surgery, who are sitting in the front row, who are leaving now, who after decades of doing acute care surgery are still coming to the college and being part of the activity. And I think that speaks volumes for their legacy. Thank you very much. But along those lines, what you heard today, and I think is important, is that not everybody needs a hematologist. Not everybody needs a cardiologist to say yay or nay. And this is important. So to Paul's point about patients showing up the day before and therefore getting canceled, that is a huge patient dissatisfier. That is money lost for the institution, and that becomes problematic for your department of surgery. So there's a whole host of reasons that begin with good patient care and also are compliant with the world of surgery and the healthcare system that we're operating in, that it behooves us to really start being part of this conversation of a surgical home. Any other comments you all want to make?
I would make one last comment about the surgical home and in terms of who's going to manage things. And we heard before that there's a lot of people that treat the NOACs and the docs as the same as warfarin. And what I always tell the patient in the office, that this is my plan for you. If anybody tells you anything differently at the pre-op clinic or your medical doctor calls you and said, oh no, you need to cancel your surgery because they're going to manage it differently, give me a call. And we also have a policy over at our the pre-op testing area that who's ever seeing the patient there, if they decide they need a different anticoagulant management before they just do that and tell the patient, it requires a call to the surgeon. A lot of times we'll have it modified because they want to do an epidural catheter and they don't want the Plavix on board, but we've already talked to cardiology that the Plavix needs to stay, but anesthesia wants to stop it, and then we might say, well, then we're not going to do an epidural catheter. So I think communication is key if someone else is going to now change the plan that you've already laid out. So we made that a policy at our pre-op area that if they're going to change the plan that the patient comes to from the surgeon, they need to call the surgeon prior to doing it. If it was sent in by ortho or something and they weren't going to manage it, they were just going to totally defer to anesthesia, then they do whatever they wanted, obviously.
Excellent point. You had a question. Yes, sir.
What is this group doing post-operative high-risk patients, cancer patients? How folks that have not been on anticoagulants before, how long do you leave them on anticoagulants? I'm seeing the literature now saying that you should leave them on for a month, even after they leave the hospital.
Eric, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, so it's it was a little bit outside the scope of this particular process, but yeah, I think there's really emerging data now that it probably reduces their 30-day risk. And so at my institution, I do hepatobiliary and pancreatic surgery for a living, surgical oncology. So all my patients, almost by definition, they're all high risk, and they all go home. All of my patients go home now on 30 days of Lovenox, 28 days.
Any other questions? So I want to thank everybody for coming. I think what you're seeing here is a diverse panel that bring multiple different experiences to the table. you're seeing how we can collaborate well with the younger people in the college, our residents, our fellows, and really put together an outstanding work product. I would encourage you to please offer suggestions for future topics. We take these very seriously. I would anticipate that our perioperative pain management paper that will be coming out will find its way as a session in hopefully next year's Clinical Congress, and we hope to see you back. And I would also encourage you to find an opportunity within your local chapters or your subspecialty chapters to serve the college in some way. It's often, you know, where we feel like we're part of this big mass and we may be insignificant, but really it just takes one person to do the next right thing, and the next thing you know, you're up here on the stage or you're moderating a session and you're sharing your talent and time with others who are going to benefit and therefore benefit our surgical patients as a whole. So please think about those things and see where you can become actively involved. And with that, I'd like to close the session and thank all my speakers and my co-moderator for a wonderful event. Thank you very much.